along the way, help someone who's in your position. I have tried to live by my promise to her to do just that, to help others. So many others gave their lives, their blood, their talents. But for them, I would not be here. Justice Marshall, whose seat I've been nominated to fill, is one of those who had the courage and the intellect. He's one of the great architects of the legal battles to open doors that seemed so hopelessly and permanently sealed, and to knock down barriers that seemed so insurmountable to those of us in the pinpoint Georgias of the world. The Civil Rights Movement, Reverend Martin Luther King in the SCLC, Roy Wilkins in the NAACP, Whitney Young in the Urban League, Fannie Lou Hamer, Rosa Parks, and Dorothy Height. They changed society and made it reach out and affirmatively help. I have benefited greatly from their efforts. But for them, there would have been no road to travel. My grandparents always said there would be more opportunities for us. I can still hear my grandfather. Y'all gonna have more of a chance than me. And he was right. He felt that if others sacrificed and created opportunities for us, we had an obligation to work hard, to be decent citizens, to be fair and good people. And he was right. You see, Mr. Chairman, my grandparents grew up and lived their lives in an era of blatant segregation and overt discrimination. Their sense of fairness was molded in a crucible of unfairness. I watched as my grandfather was called boy. I watched as my grandmother suffered the indignity of being denied the use of a bathroom. But through it all, they remained fair, decent, good people. Fair in spite of the terrible contradictions in our country. They were hardworking, productive people who always gave back to others. They gave produce from the farm, fuel oil from the fuel oil truck. They bought groceries for those who were without. And they never lost sight of the promise of a better tomorrow. I follow in their footsteps, and I have always tried to give back. Over the years, I have grown and matured. I've learned to listen carefully to other points of view than to others, to think through problems, recognizing that there are no easy answers to difficult problems, to think deeply about those who will be affected by the decisions that I make and the decisions made by others. But I've always carried in my heart the world, the life, the people, the values of my youth, the values of my grandparents and my neighbors, the values of people who believed so very deeply in this country in spite of all the contradictions. It is my hope that when these hearings are completed, that this committee will conclude that I am an honest, decent, fair person. I believe that the obligations and responsibilities of a judge, in essence, involve just such basic values. A judge must be fair and impartial. A judge must not bring to his job, to the court, the baggage of preconceived notions, of ideology, and certainly not an agenda. and the judge must get the decision right. Because when all is said and done, the little guy, the average person, the people of Pinpoint, the real people of America, will be affected not only by what we as judges do, but by the way we do our jobs. If confirmed by the Senate, I pledge that I will preserve and protect our Constitution and carry with me the values of my heritage: fairness, integrity, open-mindedness, honesty, and hard work. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very, very much for a moving statement, Judge. Let me begin, very outset, by pointing out to you, I, for one, do not in any way doubt your honesty, your decency, or your fairness. But if I could make an analogy, I am interested in what you think, how you think. I don't doubt for a moment the honesty, decency, or fairness, Senator Hatch. I don't doubt for a moment the honesty, decency, or fairness of Senator Metzenbaum. But I sure have a choice of which one I would put on the bench. Because they're both honest. I mean this sincerely now. It's an important point, at least if you understand what I have in mind. The fact you're honest, the fact you're decent, the fact you're fair, the fact you have honed sensibilities mean a lot to me. But what I want to do the next half hour and the next several days is to go beyond that. I will concede easily, because it's true, those points, no question. As we lawyers say, let's stipulate to the fact you're honest, decent, and fair. And let's get about the business of finding out why anyone who ever had the nuns can remember their eighth grade nun. Mine was Mother Agnes Constance. I don't know why I remember it so vividly. I suspect we both know why we remember so vividly.
Dare not forget.
And we both know they never forget. I made a speech not too many years ago, a commencement speech at St. Joseph's University. After the speech was over, I felt that finger that I'm sure you felt in the middle of your back. And I heard, "Joey Biden, why did you say I instead of me in such and such a sentence?" It's a true story. Turned around, was my seventh grade nun. So we both have at least that in common. And let's see what we can find out about whether or not we have in common, if anything, about the broader philosophic constructs upon which the Constitution can and must be informed. Judge, as Senator Danforth said, he hopes we have read your speeches. I assure you, I have read all of your speeches, and I have read them in their entirety. And as I indicated in my opening statement, what I want to talk about a little bit is one of the things you mentioned repeatedly in your speeches, so that I can be better informed about what you mean by it. Whether you're speaking the speech you delivered on the occasion of Martin Luther King's birthday, national holiday, and whether it should be one, to a conservative audience, making the point that he should be looked to with more reverence, or whether or not it was your speech at the Pacific Institute, or whether or not it's the Harvard Journal, whatever it is, you repeatedly invoke the phrase natural rights or natural law. And as I said at the outset, there's good natural law, if you will, and bad natural law in terms of informing the Constitution. And there are a whole new school of thought in America that would like very much to use natural law to lower the protection for individuals in the zone of personal privacy, and I will speak to those later, and who want to heighten the protection for businesses and corporations. Now, one of those people is a Professor Macedo, a fine first-class scholar at Harvard University. Another is Mr. Epstein, a professor at the University of Chicago. And in the speech you gave in 1987 to the Pacific Research Institute, you said, and I quote, "I find attractive the arguments of scholars such as Stephen Macedo, who defend an activist Supreme Court that would, not could, would strike down laws restricting property rights." My question is a very simple one, Judge. What exactly do you find attractive about the arguments of Professor Macedo and other scholars like him?
Senator, again, it's been quite some time since I've read Professor Macedo and others. That was, I believe, 87 or 88. My interest in the whole area was as a political philosophy. My interest was in reassessing and demonstrating a sense that we understood what our founding fathers were thinking when they used phrases such as "all men are created equal" and what that meant for our form of government. I found Macedo interesting and his arguments interesting as I remembered. Again, it's been quite some time, but I don't believe that in my writings I have indicated that we should have an activist Supreme Court or that we should have any form of activism on the Supreme Court. Again, I found his arguments interesting. And I was not talking particularly with natural law, Mr. Chairman, in context of adjudication.
Well, I'm not quite sure I understand your answer, Judge. You indicated that you find the arguments not interesting, attractive. And you explicitly say one of the things you find attractive, I'm quoting from you, "I find attractive the arguments of scholars such as Stephen Macedo, who defend an activist Supreme Court that would strike down laws restricting property rights." Now, it would seem to me what you were talking about is you find attractive the fact that they're activists and they'd like to strike down existing laws that impact on restricting the use of property rights.
Well,
because, you know, that's what they write about.
Let me clarify something. I think it's important, Mr. Chairman. As I indicated, I believe, or attempted to allude to in my confirmation to the Court of Appeals, I don't see a role for the use of natural law in constitutional adjudication. My interest in exploring natural law and natural rights was purely in the context of political theory. I was interested in that. There were debates that I had with individual, and I pursued that on a part-time basis. I was an agency chairman.
Judge, in preparing for these hearings, some suggest that might be your answer.
Yeah.
So I went back through some of your writings and speeches to see if I misread them. And quite frankly, I find it hard to square your speeches, which I'll discuss with you in a minute, what you're telling me today. Just let me read some of your quotes. In a speech before the Federalist Society at the University of Virginia, in a variation of that speech that you published in the Harvard Journal of Law and Policy, you praised the first Justice Harlan's opinion in Plessy versus Ferguson, and you said, "Implicit reliance on political first principles was implicit rather than explicit, as is generally appropriate for the court's opinions. He gives us a foundation for interpreting not only cases involving race, but the entire Constitution and its scheme of protecting rights." You went on to say, "Harlan's opinion provides one of our best examples of natural law and higher law jurisprudence." And then you say, "The higher law background of the American government, whether explicitly applied to, appealed to or not, provides the only firm basis for a just and wise constitutional decision." And Judge, what I'd like to know is, I find it hard to understand how you can say that what you're now saying, that natural law was only, you're only talking about the philosophy in a general philosophic sense and not how it informed or impacted upon constitutional interpretation.
Well, let me attempt to clarify. That, in fact, though, was my approach. I was interested in the political theory standpoint. I was not interested in constitutional adjudication. I was not, at the time, adjudicating cases. But with respect to the background, I think that we can both agree that the founders of our country, or at least some of the drafters of our Constitution and our Declaration, believed in natural rights. And my point was simply that in understanding overall our constitutional government, that it was important that we understood how they believed, or what they believed, in natural law or natural rights. Now, my purpose was this. In looking at this entire area, the question for me was, from a political theory standpoint, you and I are sitting here in Washington, D.C. with Abraham Lincoln or with Frederick Douglass, and from a theory, how do we get out of slavery? There is no constitutional amendment. There's no provision in the Constitution, but by what theory? And repeatedly, Lincoln referred to the notion that all men are created equal. And that was my attraction to, or beginning of my attraction to, this approach. But I did not, and would maintain that I did not feel that natural rights or natural law has a basis or has a use in constitutional adjudication.
Well, Judge, what was the, let's go back to Macedo then. What was the political theory you found so attractive that Mr. Macedo was espousing?
The only thing that I could think of with respect to, and I'll tell you how I got to the issue of property rights and the issue of the approach or what I was concerned about. What I was concerned was this. If you ended slavery, and it's something that I don't know whether I alluded to it in that speech, but it's something that troubled me, even in my youth. If you ended slavery and you had black codes, for example, or you had laws that did not allow my grandfather to enjoy the fruits of his labor, prevented him from working, and you did have that. You had people who had to work for $3 a day. I told you what my mother's income was. By what theory do you protect that? I don't think that I have explicitly endorsed Macedo. I found his arguments interesting, and again, that's been...
Talk about any of those things, Judge.
I understand that. I read more than explicit areas. I read about natural law, even though my grandfather didn't talk about
natural
law.
But, I mean, isn't it kind of... I'll come back to Macedo, but let me... You also said in that speech... out at the Pacific Research Institute, you said, quote, "I am far from being a scholar on Thomas Jefferson, but two of his statements suffice as a basis for restoring our original founding belief and reliance on natural law. And natural law, when applied to America, means not medieval stultification, but the liberation of commerce." You speak many times, I won't bore you with them, but I have pages and pages of quotes where you talk about natural law not in the context of your grandfather, not in the context of race, not in the context of equality, but you talk about it in the context of commerce, just like it is talked in the context, that context, by Macedo and by Epstein and others in their various books, a new fervent area of scholarship that basically says, hey, look, we, the modern day court, has not taken enough time to protect people's property, the property rights of corporations, the property rights of individuals, the property rights of businesses. And so what we have to do is we have to elevate the way we've treated protecting property. We have to elevate that to make it harder for governments to interfere with the ability of, in the case of Epstein, the ability to have zoning laws, the ability to have pollution laws, the ability to have laws that protect the public welfare. And then you say, in another place in one of your speeches, you say, well, look, I think that property rights should be given, let me find the exact quote, should be given the exact same protection as you say, economic rights are as protected as much as any other rights in a speech to the American Bar Association. Now, Judge, understand my confusion. Economic rights now are not protected as much as any other rights. They are not protected that way now. They are given, if they pass a rational basis test, in effect, it's all right to restrict property. When you start to restrict things that have to do with privacy and thought and process, then you have to have a much stricter test. And so you quote Macedo, you talk about the liberation of commerce and natural law, whatever you want to call it, natural law or not, and then you say economic rights. And by the way, you made that speech to the ABA the day after you made the speech where you praised Macedo. Can you tell me, can you enlighten me on how this was just some sort of philosophic musing?
Well, that's exactly what it was. I was interested in exactly what I've said I was interested in, and I think I have indicated in my confirmation to the Court of Appeals that I did not see a role for the application of natural rights to constitutional adjudication. And I stand by that.
Judge, you argue Harlan did just that, and it was a good thing for him to have done. He applied this theory of natural rights, as you say, in his dissent in Plessy.
I thought that...
And he should have, you say.
Well, the argument was I felt that slavery was wrong, that segregation was wrong.
Right.
And again, I argue, and I have stood by that, that these positions that I have taken, from the standpoint of philosophical or from the standpoint of political theory.
Well, Judge, let me find...
Well, let me, if I could have an opportunity,
sure. Oh, please.
Mr. Chairman.
Please.
My interest in this area started with the notion, with a simple question. How do you end slavery? By what theory do you end slavery? After you end slavery, by what theory do you protect the right of someone who was a former slave, or someone like my grandfather, for example, to enjoy the fruits of his or her labor? At no point did I or do I believe that the approach of natural law or that natural rights has a role in constitutional adjudication. I attempted to make that plain or to allude to that in my confirmation to the Court of Appeals, and I think that that's the position that I take here.
Okay, Judge. Well, look, let's not call it natural law, natural rights, whatever. What do you mean when you say economic rights are protected as much as any other rights in the Constitution? What do you mean by that?
Well, the simple point was that notions like, for me, at this point, and again, I have not gone back and I don't know the text of all those speeches, but there are takings clause. There is the taking clause in the Constitution, and there's also a reference to property in our Constitution. That does not necessarily mean that in constitutional adjudication that the protection would be at the same level that we protect other rights, nor did I suggest that in constitutional adjudication that that would happen. But it certainly does deserve some protection.
But Judge,
and certainly the right of my grandfather to work deserves protection.
The right of my grandfather Finnegan to work, too, deserved protection, and your grandfather to work. But the issue here is whether, and look, let me explain to you why I'm concerned about this. You know why, and let's make sure other people know why.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole new school of thought that up until about 5 years ago only spoke to one another, that is now receiving wider credence and credibility, to the point that former Solicitor General Charles Freed, in his book Order and Law, not a liberal Democrat, Reagan's Solicitor General, said in his book about this group of scholars to whom Macedo and others like you refer, maybe you didn't mean the same thing, but this group of scholars, meaning Macedo and Epstein and others who I'll mention in a moment, he says, devotees, it says, fledgling Federalist societies and often devotees of the extreme libertarian views of Chicago law professor Richard Epstein had a specific, aggressive, and it seemed to me quite radical project in mind, meaning for the administration. And it seemed to me a quite radical project in mind to use the takings clause, and I don't have much time, so I won't go into it, but you and I both know the takings clause is that portion of the Fifth Amendment that has nothing to do with self-incrimination. It says if the government's going to take your property, they have to pay for it. Except historically, we've said, if it's regulating your property, it is not taking it. If it's regulating under the police power to prevent pollution or whatever else, then it's not taking it, and it doesn't have to pay for it. And what these guys want to do is they want to change, use that takings clause, like the 14th Amendment was used during the Lochner era. This is Freed speaking. It says, had a specific, aggressive, and it seemed to me quite radical project in mind, to use the takings clause of the Fifth Amendment to serve as a brake upon federal and state regulation of business and property. The grand plan was to make government pay compensation for taking property every time its regulation impinged. Now, that's what this is all about, Judge. And again, I'm not saying that that's your view, but it seems to me when you say, which nobody else who writes in this area, I don't know anybody, and I've read a lot about this area, I don't know anybody else who uses the phrases natural law, property, the takings clause, who doesn't stand for the proposition that Macedo and Epstein stand for, which is that we got this little out of whack. We got to elevate the standard of review we use when we look at property. Just to the same standard, to use your phrase, the same rights as personal rights that most Americans think to be personal, whether they can assemble, whether or not they can go out and speak, whether or not they can worship, whether or not they can have privacy in their own bedroom. And so these guys want to change that balance. But that's why I'm asking you this. I'll come back to it in a minute in my second round. But let me shift, if I may.
Respond.
Oh, yeah, please, yeah.
First of all, I would like to just simply say, and I think it is appropriate, that I do not consider myself a member of that school of thought. And secondly, I think that the post-Lochner era cases were correctly decided. My interest in natural rights were purely from a political theory standpoint, and as a part-time political theorist. I was not a law professor, nor was I adjudicating cases. And as I indicated and have indicated, I do not think that the natural rights or natural law has an appropriate use in constitutional adjudication.
Well, Judge, I'd ask for the record, and I'll make these available to you, that all the references you make that I have found, and there's pages of them, where you explicitly connect natural law with either specific cases or talk about informing specific aspects of constitutional interpretation, be entered in the record. And in my second round, I'll be able to talk with you about them. You'll have had a chance to read them. But let me move, if I may, for a second. As I said earlier, I mentioned that concomitant with those who want to sort of raise up the economic protections of business and corporation to make it harder for government to regulate them without paying them, which is a multi-billion dollar change in the law, where, for not your view, where Mr. Epstein's views to take place, be a multi-billion dollar expense for the taxpayers if they wanted to continue to regulate the way we now regulate and consider reasonable. As I mentioned earlier, there's a second zone of individual rights, a zone which includes such rights as free speech, religion, and privacy in the family. These rights are also protected by the Constitution as informed by natural law principles. Now, you say that's not what you mean, informed by natural law principles, but some of the specific protections are very specific. For example, the Fourth Amendment guarantees personal privacy in a particular context, illegal search and seizures. And other protections are more general, like the 14th Amendment that says no state, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Now, Judge, in your view, does the Liberty Clause of the 14th Amendment protect the right of women to decide for themselves in certain instances whether or not to terminate pregnancy?
Senator, first of all, let me look at that in the context other than with natural law principles.
Let's forget about natural law principles.
My view is that there is a right to privacy in the 14th Amendment.
Well, Judge, does that right to privacy in the Liberty Clause of the 14th Amendment protect the right of a woman to decide for herself in certain instances whether or not to terminate a pregnancy?
Senator, I think that the Supreme Court has made clear that the issue of marital privacy is protected, that the state cannot infringe on that without a compelling interest. And the Supreme Court, of course, in the case of Roe v. Wade, has found an interest in the woman's right to, as a fundamental interest, the woman's right to terminate a pregnancy. I would not, I do not think that at this time that I could maintain my impartiality as a member of the judiciary and comment on that specific case.
Well, let's try it another way, Judge. I don't want to ask you to comment on specifically on Roe then. What I'm trying to get at is there are two schools of thought out there. There's fellas, there's a gentleman like Professor Michael Moore of the University of Pennsylvania, and Mr. Lewis Lehrman of the Heritage Foundation, who both think natural law philosophy informs their view. And they conclude, one who strongly supports a woman's right and the other one who strongly opposes a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy. And then there are those who say that, no, this should be left strictly to the legislative bodies, not for the courts to interpret. And they fall into the school of thought that represented by John Hart Ely and former Judge Robert Bork, for example, who say the court has nothing to do with that. Now, let me ask you this. Where does the decision lie? Does it lie with the court? For example, you quote with admiration the Mr. Lehrman's article. Mr. Lehrman's article was on natural law, and I forget the exact title here. Let me find it. Natural law and the right to life. And you say when you are speaking at a gathering that you think that that is a superb application of natural law. You say, it quotes, it's a splendid example of applying natural law. Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, let me go back to, I guess, my first comment to you when we were discussing natural law. I think that is important, and then come back to the question of the due process analysis. The speech that I was giving there was before the Heritage Foundation. Again, as I indicated earlier, my interest was civil rights and slavery. What I was attempting to do in the beginning of that speech was to make clear to a conservative audience that blacks who were Republicans and the issues that affected blacks were being addressed and being dealt with by conservatives in what I considered a less than acceptable manner. The second point,
in what sense? In that they were not
invoking
natural law.
No. The second point that I wanted to make to them was that they had, based on what I thought was an appropriate approach, they had an obligation, just as conservatives, to be more open and more aggressive on civil rights enforcement. What I thought would be the best way to approach that would be using the underlying concept of our Constitution, that we were all created equal. One, I felt that conservatives would be skeptical about the notion of natural law. I was using that as the underlying approach. I felt that they would be conservative and that they would not or be skeptical about that concept. I was speaking in the Lou Lehrman Auditorium of the Heritage Foundation. I thought that if I demonstrated that one of their own accepted at least the concept of natural rights, that they would be more apt to accept that concept as an underlying principle for being more aggressive on civil rights. My whole interest was civil rights enforcement.
Judge, you said in that speech, the need to re-examine natural law is as current as last month's issue of Time on Ethics. Yet it is more venerable than St. Thomas Aquinas. It both transcends and underlies time and place, race and custom. And until recently, it has been an integral part of the American political tradition. Dr. King was the last prominent American political figure to appeal to it. But Heritage Trustee Lewis Lehrman's recent essay in the American Sector on the Declaration of Independence and the Meaning of the Right to Life is a splendid example of applying it. Briefly put, this thesis of natural law is that human nature provides the key to how men ought to live their lives. And then Mr. Lehrman's article goes on, not you, Mr. Lehrman's article goes on and says, because it is a natural right of a fetus, there is no ability of the legislative body to impact in any way on whether or not there can or cannot be an abortion at any time for any reason. And the court must uphold, applying natural law, the principle that abortion is wrong under all circumstances, whether it's the life of the mother or no matter what, all circumstances. Now,
it was not my intention, Mr. Chairman, as I've tried to indicate to you, to adopt. I think I've been explicit when I wanted to adopt someone or adopt a position or say something. I think I have done that. My interest in the speech, I think, is fairly clear, or it's very clear. My interest was in the aggressive enforcement of civil rights. Remember the context. I'm in the Reagan administration. I've been engaged in significant battles throughout my tenure. It is toward the end of the Reagan administration, and I feel that conservatives have taken an approach on civil rights where they have become comfortable with notions that it is okay to simply be against quotas or to be against busing or to be against voting rights and consider that a civil rights agenda. What I was looking for were unifying themes in a political standpoint, not a constitutional adjudication standpoint. And I used themes that I thought that one of their champions had in a way adopted, not adopting his analysis or adopting his approach, but adopting a theme that he used to serve the purposes that I thought were very important.
Well, just in picking up that context, you were part of the Reagan administration. In 86, as a member of that administration, you were part of what's been referred to here, the administration's working group on the family. And this group put out what I think can only be characterized as a controversial report. And you signed that report, which recommends more state regulation of the family than is now allowed under the law. That report concludes that the Supreme Court's privacy decisions for the last 20 years are fatally flawed and should be corrected. Judge, did you read this report before it was released?
Well, let me explain to you how working groups work in
Sure.
the domestic policy context or the way that they worked in the administration. Normally, what would happen is that there would be a number of informal meetings.
Do you have that document?
At those meetings, you would express your, there would be some discussion around the table. My interest was in low-income families. After several meetings, transmitted to the head of that working group my views on the low-income family and the need to address the problems of low-income families in the report. The report, as it normally works in these working groups in domestic policy, the report is not finalized, nor is it a team effort in drafting. You are submitted your document. That document is then, as far as I know, it may be sent around or may not be sent around. But there's no signature required on those. And it's normal.
Read the report, Judge?
The section that I read was on the family. I was only interested in whether they included my comments on the low-income family.
But at any time, even after it was published?
No, I did not.
You haven't to this moment read that report?
To this day, I have not read that report. I read the sections on low-income families.
There was an awful lot of discussion in the press and controversy about it.
There was controversy about it. I was interested in low-income families.
Well,
if you worked with the domestic policy group or the working groups at the White House, what one quickly learns is that you send your input, that input is reduced to what they want it reduced to.
Gotcha.
And then the report is circulated and final.
Well, let me conclude. This is the last thing I will ask you. This report, which is only 67 pages long, of which your report is part of, and I acknowledge you're suggesting, telling us that you did not read the report before or after, and your part was only a small part of this. But in this report, take my word for it, it says that one of these fatally flawed decisions, and they explicitly pick out one, is the Moore versus the city of East Cleveland, where the city of East Cleveland said a grandmother raising two grandchildren who are cousins and not brothers is violating the zoning law and therefore has to do one of two things, move out of the neighborhood or tell one of her grandchildren to leave. As you know that case, I believe, that was appealed to the Supreme Court, that grandmother. And the court said, hey, no, she has an absolute right of privacy to be able to have two of those grandchildren, even though they're cousins, to live with her, and no zoning law can tell her otherwise. Now, this report says that explicitly, it says that the city of East Cleveland and other cities should be able to pass such laws if they want, and they should be upheld. And if we can't get them upheld, then we should change the court. That's what this report says. Now, and they say that the cities and states should be able to establish norms of a traditional family. If you will give me the benefit of the doubt that I'm telling you the truth and accurately characterizing the report on that point, do you agree with what I suggested to you is the conclusion of that report in the section you have not read?
I have heard recently that that was the conclusion, but I'd like to make a point there. I think that, and I think the Supreme Court's rulings in the privacy area support, that the notion of family is one of the most personal and the most private relationships that we have in our country. If I had, of course, known that that section was in the report before it became final, of course I would have expressed my concerns.
Outrageous, isn't it? Isn't it an outrageous suggestion?
That would have had direct implications on my own family, that I could easily have been zoned out of my neighborhood should approaches like that take place. But my point to you, and I think it's very, very important, Senator, is this, that when you're involved or were involved in a working group in the White House, we were more in the nature of resource people. This was not a committee report. This was not a conference report, which was circulated normally for comment. It was something generally that you provided your input, and I provided a significant memo, I believe, on low-income family and families that I felt were at risk in the society and how we should approach resolving those families. I do not remember there being any discussion of the final draft.
Well, I have much more to ask you, Judge. We're going to go back, when I get a chance again, to the Macedo quote and the ABA speech and the Lehrman speech and this report. But quite frankly, at this point, you leave me with more questions than answers. But let me yield to my distinguished colleague, Senator Thurmond.